Today's Taisho will be on case 44 in the Wumenquan, the Mumonkan, Basho's staff, Matsu's staff. Case 44, Basho Osho said to his disciples, "If you have a staff, I will give you a staff. If you have no staff, I will take it from you." Mumon's comment, "It helps me wade across a river when the bridge is down. It accompanies me to the village on a moonless night. If you call it a staff, you will enter hell like an arrow." Mumon's verse, "The depths and shallows of the world are all in its grasp. It supports the heavens and sustains the earth. Everywhere it enhances the Dhamma." Today is day 4 of our spring 2009, our March 2009 Sesshin. And once again, everybody did a wonderful job in the in this endo this morning. It's a beautiful spring day, right? This is like perfect. Beautiful sunny day, spring is here. There was still frost on the grass, but you can feel the days are longer, spring is on the way. We're here together getting up and doing this beautiful practice of Zazen, of Sesshin. And everything was very still in the Zendo this morning. It was wonderful to see. I love these morning sits. You know, my favorite sit of the day is in the morning. And I realize that three sits in a row is a long stretch, without a break. But on the other hand, you can really see, when you get up, your mind is often quite clear. I mean, one of the things you've probably noticed about Sesshin is that you have crazy dreams, yes? Maybe you've noticed that some of your dreams are like insane dreams. And this is just because you have more access to what's going on in your mind. Normally, people are so oblivious to what's going on in their mind. They have these crazy dreams, but they wake up and they don't remember them and so on. But sometimes in Sesshin you have access to different compartments or layers of your mind, and you have these crazy dreams, but often when you get up you feel your mind is very calm and still. It's done all that processing, and when you come to the cushion, the mind has a kind of freshness or stillness that's quite wonderful. And also, when you get up in the morning, I don't know how it is for you, but I'm always amazed at the restorative power of sleep. I've gone to more than 100 sesshin. I don't know how many sesshin, and sometimes I've limped my way to the bed. It's just like I feel like my legs will never be right again, and I lie down, go to sleep, and you get up in the morning and it's like, the muscles have healed, they feel fresher, they're soft again, and it's like, what happened to the broken legs? They're okay, So the body and the mind are nice and fresh, and you sit down on the cushion and then go into deep samadhi, and it's just the sun is coming up. It's just the most beautiful experience. And this morning I was expecting to have like a really sleepy sit, because I build up, I'm sure some of you have noticed this, As the session goes on, I develop a lot of energy, like a lot of energy. And usually on day, maybe day, like day three, four, somewhere around there, five, I don't necessarily, can't really get to sleep, you know. So last night I was, I thought I was tired, and I lay down on the bed, and then I thought, you know how you're just about on the edge of sleep, you start drifting off to sleep, you can feel, it's like loosening up, it's like your consciousness is sort of loosening up and starting to drift. And then I heard some noise, and my brain, my mind, rather, just went straight to that noise, and all my senses came back. It was like the machine was winding down, but everything came back on, you know, and I was just, my body felt like it was humming, you know. So when this happens, it means I'm not going to sleep, you know. And it's not, you know, if you sit there and go, oh my God, I've got to get to sleep, you know, it just makes everything worse, you know. If you do Zazen, eventually this will happen to you, you know. You'll just have so much energy at the end of the night. And Genki Roshi used to get up and, you know, he would do things. You know, he'd get up, he'd go into the kitchen and make something for breakfast, or I know another Roshi, I know Edo Roshi, reads. He gets up and reads, you know, during session he does a lot of reading at night because he can't sleep. And it's quite common. Eventually this energy is present even when you're not, sometimes not in sesshin, you know. We used to get to the Zen Center, I think around 4:30 or 5 o'clock in Seattle, and Genki would have been up long, you know, he'd be down in the basement, you could hear his pottery wheel, his wheel turning, his electric wheel, and we'd knock on the door, you know, and he'd come up, you know, is it, you know, basically, he'd go, Genki, you know, and, huh? You know, and he'd come up and take off his potter's robe and put on his monk's robe. And then we'd do Zazen and have breakfast, and then I think sometimes he'd go back down, and sometimes he had to go to work. So, anyway, last night was one of those nights. I was just humming or reverberating with energy, and I couldn't sleep. And it's best to just say, okay, fine, you know, I'll just lie here, you know, and just relax, you know, listen to the sounds, you know, and just, you know, not worry about it. But I thought I was going to have a sleepy sit, and yet today the sit was just wonderful, you know. I didn't sleep, my mind was quite fresh, and I had a wonderful time. And at one point, I was looking around the Zendo to see how everybody was doing. And everybody was sitting so still, and my eye went over here, and it sort of swept across the Zendo, and it was like, hmm? And I noticed one person in particular was sitting very still. And I thought, wow, that's great. You know, that is fantastic. And so, you know, throughout the rest of the morning, I would look over there, and this person's sitting like a rock. I thought, that is so cool, you know. That's really wonderful, really exciting, you know. I mean, especially if it's your first session, you know, this just seems like a crazy thing to do, you know. I can remember my first session and just being, you know, I mean, I remember being in a lot of pain after like the first two sits, you know. I came to Sesshin without any significant prior preparation, you know, and basically after like, it wasn't even the first day, after like the first night, I was really already falling apart, and every day after that was just like hanging on by the skin of your teeth. What often happens is that, you know, you go through this and you think, oh, this is terrible, this is terrible, this is terrible. And then all of a sudden, you know, you hit. It's like a switch in your head goes on and it completely changes everything, right? It's like there's this place of extraordinary stillness. You know, you can hear somebody talk about it, but when there's no position that you can adopt that's a comfortable position, it just sounds like a load of bull, you know. And yet, if you just hang in there, you know, if you don't leave, if you just hang in there and you keep trying, you know, you're going to hit this place where, you're in this great stillness. And it's a different consciousness. It's a different consciousness. You have different, time is experienced differently. The body is experienced differently. You know, ordinary consciousness is very small, very self-centered, and it's very easily tired out. You know, actually, I think I mentioned this earlier, but a lot of people are like tired all the time. You know, they're just tired all the time. This is like small mind life, you know, is, you know, a lot of, no energy, nervous, and angry. And if you come to Sesshin, you sit on the cushion and you watch the breath and you have this pain, but at some point you just fall into this other consciousness, which we call a big mind or Buddha mind, or just samadhi. And when you're in samadhi, all of a sudden you're in this still place, and you can have this this energy. It's like, where is this coming from? You know, you're on the cushion, and all of a sudden you should be, you know, on you go through day one early in the morning, you're just barely able to stay awake. You know, you're falling over. Day two, falling over. But, you know, morning of day four, you sit down on the cushion and all of a sudden it's like there's this energy there. And it's like you've tapped into something. And you experience your body differently. You know, you might feel that your parts of your body have disappeared, or part of your body is very small and part of your body is very large. Some people feel, Genki Roshi used to say that he felt like he was emptying out like a stick of incense. So he'd feel like he's just started disappearing from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. And as this process would go on, he'd just empty out. People who hang in there long enough will hit this state. And it's really a wonderful achievement the first time you hit it, and every time you hit it. And if you keep doing it, you'll get back there more and more often, and it will be easier and easier to do it. And it's just the most wonderful state in the world, I think, because it's so different from ordinary consciousness. People have these reservoirs, these resources. You know, it's such a great pity that people spend so much time in ordinary consciousness, because it's so constricted. And this other consciousness is so wonderful and so beautiful. And there's this energy and this deep sense of openness, I guess is one way to describe it. So I could see in a couple of cases where people had sort of like turned it around this morning. And you can see sometimes when somebody's in samadhi, because, day one, day two, day three, day four. See, it's like, whoa. Now, you know, the first time you enter samadhi like that in a deep, profound way, you know, day five might be, and that's okay. But once you've tasted it, you know it's there. You know that beautiful consciousness is there. And you know, Zen is all about living life from that place, you could say. You know, not ordinary consciousness, but that consciousness. And I think it's a, if I may say so, this is a value judgment, but I think it's a superior way to live for many reasons. And it's so invigorating. Generally, people in that state feel more alive, and also they feel kinder, and so on. So I highly recommend it, but it does take some work. You know, let's face it. I mean, Sesshin is not everybody's path, and it is definitely a challenge. The other day, I'm not sure some of you were, not everybody was here, but I mentioned that Sandy's husband Bob had been in the Marines, and he said that Sesshin was tougher than Marine training camp. And that's accurate, that seems fair to me. I remember back in Seattle, there was a person who started coming to our Zen group who was convinced that he had had Daikensho, that he was like enlightened. And basically he wanted to talk to the head man, to Genki. It was like one enlightened man to another, right, you know. And he was very sure. And anyway, he started sitting with us a little bit. But the interesting thing was he would not come to Sesshin. It was like, no way, right? And the thing is, I know that if he had come to Sesshin, it would have just been, it would be impossible to sustain the illusion of his enlightenment. I think he was quite careful, I don't need Sesshin, you know. And I think he was quite careful to stay away because, this cuts through all of these illusions so quickly. It's easy to imagine you're enlightened if you've read some books on Eastern philosophy, and if you do something in your home, you do some kind of mantra recitation or something, even do koans, it's easy to imagine that you're there or you're getting close, and when you come to Sesshin, it's such a different experience, right? I mean, no matter how long you've been to Sesshin, there's going to be a moment where you're hanging on by the skin of your teeth. You know, I hope I don't discourage you, but that's going to happen. You know, and that is what makes it possible to have this tremendous opening. It makes it possible to have this tremendous opening up. And in fact, there's no end to Zen practice. If some of you were thinking, I mentioned that there was a person who used to be in our group who quit after 6 years. He didn't come to Sesshin all the time, but after 6 years he quit and said, I haven't had enlightenment yet, so, I'm not going to continue to do this. I think he had thought, okay, 6 years and I'm out of here, and then it's on to something else. Like, first I'll have enlightenment, then I'll make my first million, then I'll be I'll run for president. But Zen training, Zen practice goes on forever because there's always more and more to know. And I love the fact that every time you come to Sesshin, there's always some new door to open. And I would be so disappointed if every Sesshin was just the same old bliss, come in, sit down, bliss, yeah. It's not like that. It's there's always a bigger horizon, There's always something that bugs you. There's always something that you're afraid of. And you just keep opening doors and working through barriers, and it's a wonderful way to live. Uh, so So I was so happy when I saw this person have this really like karmically significant event, right? Because once you've been through 3 or 4 days of sesshin and you've been struggling, and then suddenly you have this taste of samadhi, this is like karmically transformative. It's like, I don't think a person can be the same after that. Even if at some point that person says, I don't want to do Zen anymore, that person is a different person, because they know that the world that normal consciousness has created is not everything, and it's not even very satisfying, that there's this bigger consciousness, you know. So that's wonderful. And if you stay there long enough, you really begin to experience reality in quite a different way. You know, I grew up on military bases when I was a kid, and they're very boring places. I mean, really extraordinary. Let me just put it this way: there aren't that many intellectuals in the armed forces, you know. So, you know, if you go to a base library, for example, you know, there's a lot of like mystery novels and Mickey Spillane murder mysteries and stuff like that. And you know, there was no like cultural life. There was nothing. A lot of kids on the base had substance abuse problems, and there was a fair amount of crime, actually, because it was just such an unhealthy place. I used to read I used to go to the library, the base library, and read National Geographic, you know. And I would read about Tibet and think, oh my God, this is amazing. Amazing. You know, this amazing culture, you know. And I just thought, this is where all these enlightened people live. It just seemed, I just thought, this is the most, and so I had this image of the mystical East, you know, I went to a Tibetan center eventually in Seattle, but there wasn't any real teacher there, then I heard that Genki Roshi had come from Japan. And I started sitting with Genki Roshi, and then shortly after that I went to my first sesshin. But I had this idea of enlightenment as this, you know, very mystical thing. And I thought it was going to like deliver me from all my problems, you know. I really did think that if I could just have enlightenment, you know, this, who knows? You know, it's like, maybe, you know, I would just be able to think, you know, just think of money and, you know, money would be in my wallet. Or, you know, somehow I didn't think of it concretely like that, you know. I imagined that, you know, this was going to solve all my problems. And I believed very much in, like, transcendence, you know, that I was going to experience something very, very unusual and, you know, I don't know how to put it, mystical, you know. So when I came to my first sesshin, and I was so surprised that you had all this pain, because I actually thought that you know, Genki Roshi, I thought sesshin, you know, I had no idea. This is going to sound so stupid, but I really did think, you know, Genki Roshi was going to, like, we'd go into the Dokusan room and he'd go, okay, here's, you know, think red, you know, then, you know, try to rotate that in your mind and, you know, something like that, you know, like, or can you read me now? Yes, Genki, I'm getting those signals, you know. You know, I really thought that way, even though, I mean, people have like a rational self, you know, but under the surface there's this other self, right, you know, so there's stuff we don't publicly state, maybe even to ourselves, but underneath there's like these beliefs, right, you know. So I really did think, you know, on some level, Well, years ago, Jaru asked me to speak to her class about Zen, and there was a person there who said, "Can monks fly?" And I said, "No, they cannot fly." And the person was so disappointed. And indeed, one of the members of our group is from an Asian background, and in one of the Te shows, I actually said, on a Saturday, I said, I talked about another occasion in which somebody told me that monks could fly, you know. And this person came up to me and said, I don't know whether I can believe you or not, because, you know, my parents raised me to believe that there are monks who can fly. And the student who was at the university in Jaru's class had told me that his parents had told him that there were monks who could fly, but they only flew when no one was around. So that's perfect, right? That's the perfect system. We can fly, but only when no one's around. Yeah. But I believed that, you know. I didn't imagine I was going to have all this pain, you know. And I kept thinking of enlightenment as this very lofty and very unusual thing. So when Genki Roshi asked me to watch my breath, I almost felt insulted, you know, I thought, come on, this is for babies, you know, give me the real deal here, you know, the real teachings, you know, the esoteric teachings, you know, and as I've said before, you know, I would go in, you know, he'd say, watch your breath, and I just thought, oh, this is bullshit, you know, I want the real stuff. And yes, I've been watching my breath, you know, and then I tried to jazz it up, you know. I'd say, you know, I'd go in and say, all is one, you know, it's all one, you know. It was all just bullshit, you know. I just couldn't watch my breath, because I just wanted to have this mystical experience, this great, I really wanted, like, I would sit down on the cushion and, you know, all of a sudden everything would open up. And I wasn't a very good Zen student, because I didn't look at the small things, you know, because I didn't think they were important. In our system in Seattle, people were appointed to officer positions for 6 months. So if you were the Jikijitsu, you know, your job was to run the sits for 6 months. So for half a year, you would come to two sesshins, and you'd be the timekeeper. And we used to have a stick, it's for hitting people on the back. And when Nobuko goes to Japan, she'll make the acquaintance of the teaching stick, as it's called, I don't like it. It's part of the Zen tradition there's like a sergeant in the Zendo, and if anybody moves, they yell at you and they might hit you with the stick. It's not like a random blow. You have a meaty part of your back. And you bend over and they hit you, and it has a flat surface, and it makes quite a whacking sound. It's terrifying, really, I thought. But it doesn't really hurt that much. Stings, but if you look, there's no bruise or anything. I don't like this idea. I think it's unnecessary. Somebody would be the Jikijitsu and would carry the stick around and yell at people if they moved. And then somebody would be the tenzo, the cook, the tienzo. It was a lot of work to do any of these jobs, but in particular, it was a lot of work to be the cook. I myself really didn't want to be an officer, because my goal was not to get bogged down in all that stuff. My goal was to have enlightenment. I did not want to be an officer of any kind. And Genki Roshi asked me to be the tenzo. And so I accepted the job with great reluctance, since you couldn't really say no. But I used to work in a restaurant, you know, so I really approached it like I didn't realize that I could be a good tenzo, but once I started doing the job, I got into it, you know, unexpectedly. And I really got into it. And I remember we had a sesshin, and I made all kinds of dishes that we didn't usually make at sesshin, you know. And usually the food at sesshin was really quite terrible, as a matter of fact. And so people were, it was like, this is interesting. You know, this is actually not terrible, you know. And I worked really hard being the tenzo. I remember after the first sesshin where I was tenzo, we were driving home and I was so exhausted from, here we all worked together to do the food, but the cook had a few assistants, but pretty much the cook's job was just to do all of this stuff. And so the cook would be, it was really like one of these dawn to dusk jobs, you know, you would come in and listen to Dokusan. And you might have a few sits in the evening, but otherwise you were just toiling away back there in solitude, you know. So anyway, I did this job and really threw myself into it. And I made things like eggplant, you know, Parmesan and things like that I'd learned to make in the restaurant. And I even baked bread, you know. But at the end of it, I was so wiped out. I remember being in the car, and I just literally, somebody said I fell asleep in mid-sentence, you know. Anyway, the second sesshin was the same story, you know, and at the end of the sesshin, Genki Roshi called me in, and he said, I've really been impressed with your activities at the sesshin. He said it this way. He said, this is the first time I've seen you, you know, basically he didn't quite say do something that wasn't selfish. He didn't put it that way, but he said, this is the first time I've seen you do something that was, a real giving of yourself, you know. And he passed me on the breath perception koan because I wasn't able to pass that koan because I just kept trying to say something profound, you know. But it gave me such a good feeling to make this bread for people. And actually, you know, when people would come at the end of the day, after sitting, people would come into the kitchen, and I had like bread out, sliced bread for a little snack before people went to bed, and I laid out some honey or something, and I'd see people take the bread, and if they didn't take bread, I'd be disappointed, you know. And I really did wind up caring for those people, you know. And this was really my first experience of a Buddha mind, really. You know, eventually, if you stay in a samadhi long enough, you begin to experience everything as like part of your life. You know, and you realize that you really can't. If you are going to be pursuing this path, pretty soon you find yourself caring about other people more than you did, and this sort of sense of connectedness spills over into everything around you. You know, so at the beginning of the sesshin, I talked about. You know, how we put our sandals down. And Genki Roshi always used to say, and he'd say, I can always tell, you know, a person by his sandals, you know, and I thought, oh, please, you know. But, actually, we make a conventional people make a distinction between yours and mine, or they make a distinction between the animate and the inanimate, or the human and the animal, you know. But if you stay in samadhi long enough, you begin to realize that everything is alive, you know, everything is like alive, even like your shoes. Now that doesn't, you know, we have a lot of cultural conditioning that says that's not so, shoes are not alive. But that's just cultural conditioning. That's like believing that spiders are bad for you. You know? I began to realize that, you know, the care I took with my shoes, or the care I took with this is all like part of taking care of my true nature. You know, how you put flowers in a vase, you know, it's your body, so be careful, you know, with it. It's not a game. It's really not. There's, you know, it's possible to say something like this. You know, what are you Zen people doing anyway? You know, here we've got global warming. We've got real problems. And what are you doing? You're sitting on your cushions. You know, my father had contempt for Zen. And he used to call it navel gazing. So have you been navel gazing again? You know? And I said, actually, I can't see my navel when I sit there. But he had this idea that, you know, this is like yoga. You're staring at your own navel for hours on end, you know. And then he'd have another drink, you know. My dad was trapped in a lot of ways, and I mean, I loved him, but the thing is that, you know, we want to say, look, there's the big issues, you know, global warming, and then there's the less important things, you know. But actually, I don't think that's true. I think that's a conventional wisdom that's not true. Right now, all these people are running around. I was just reading about this conference of scientists, you know. And the scientists were all down in the dumps. They were all getting depressed, you know, because they're climate scientists, and they just like have huge, they go around toting big boxes of data and trying to show it to people. And they're going, look, don't you see? And you know, Al Gore has made this movie, and he's worked so hard, and everybody talks, but nobody's behavior is really changing. And I think it's because it's all on the level of, it hasn't solved the basic problem, which is to treat the world as yourself, you know. And we have a sense of like a big problem, but we don't really know how to solve it, and so. You know, basically, nothing really changes except for like the now products are wrapped in green paper, you know, and that kind of thing. But if you begin to experience your shoes as alive, even though that sounds totally crazy, if you begin to experience your shoes as alive, you begin to have a very different relationship to the world. And it's like a relationship of loving kindness to everything you encounter. And again, you know, conventional, my father would be snorting with contempt at this. But, you know, basically, this is, you know, we know intellectually that everything is interconnected. And we know that, but, you know, sometimes when you bake bread for somebody and you see their happiness, it's the deepest kind of happiness you can experience, right? It's like, you realize, you know, it's one life. You know, this is one life. And I think this is true also for you know, something like a community like this, like our Sangha. You know, people have come here and made great sacrifices to be here. You know, you could be doing so many things instead of this. There was a person who came, who has been coming to sit periodically, and he let me know one time that he was a very good sitter. I mean, he's a nice guy, but he actually let me know. He said, you know, I've gotten very good at this. And he said, he actually said, I think I'm becoming a little arrogant about it. And he was deadly serious, you know. And he said, I'm worried about having too much pride. And I said, well, you know, how much do you sit a day? He said, I sit an hour every day. You know? And I said, well, you know, have you thought of coming to Sashin? And then I looked around and he was gone. But I said, why don't you come to Sashin? He said, I just might do that. You know, of course, he hasn't done it, you know. But he disappeared. He really did disappear after our conversation for a while, and then he came back, and I was glad to see him. And I said, I was sort of in your face about it. I said, hey, you know, we have a Sashin coming up. And he said, well, I just can't, you know, I've got work. And I said, well, isn't there some way you could do this? And he said, well, I guess I could take some vacation time, right? And I said, well, that sounds great, you know. And he's not here, right? So I'm not giving up my vacation time, you know. But some people have given up their vacation time to be here and made other kinds of personal sacrifices as well, you know. If you add up all the time you spend practicing, if you had a second job, you might have a lot more money in your bank account, for example. But people who have this noble ideal coming together and practicing and basically helping one another, right? I mean, I think it's a really wonderful thing. To see people caring about each other. When you're cleaning, you know, you're doing the dishes is helping everybody else wake up. And you're chopping vegetables, you're expressing your love for everybody here. And not just for everybody here, but for everybody. Again, there's a part of us that says this is not true, you know. But that's not the big mind speaking. We live in a complex world, right? I mean, people say the little butterfly that, jumps off a limb in Malaysia produces the hurricane, wherever. So intellectually we know that in a complex universe, little things can make huge differences. And maybe big, one of the funny things is that, like, you know, no matter who's president, very little actually changes. You know, people think, when I get to be president, you know, even Obama, I voted for him. I would have voted more than once if I could, you know. But he's really dynamic. I love him. So many of the things he wants to do, I just think are wonderful. But in the end, you know, probably many of the things he wants to do are not going to happen. And it's the paralysis of power, you know, all these structures in the way and so on. And so people would say, well, what are you doing? You're just sitting on a cushion. But, you know, these little, people who have this capacity to get outside the self and to be in a different place, you know, who are able to act compassionately, you have no idea how, we have no idea how that resonates and what kind of impact it has. You know, I'll stop in just a minute, but I had a chance to study with a person named Edo Roshi briefly. He was a Dharma brother of my teacher. And Edo Roshi had what I would say are personal problems. Everybody has karma that he hasn't worked through. And Edo Roshi had sort of karmic obstacles that he had not managed to work through, in my opinion. And they were serious defects of character. You can say, well, how can somebody have a daikensho and still have serious defects of character? But it can happen. You know, some people have, maybe their defects of character make them practice very hard because they're unhappy, and they have great diligence and courage, and they have daikensho, but then they have personal defects. To tell you the truth, there was a Japanese man who was deeply enlightened who was an alcoholic. In fact, there's a number of people who, even a Maizumi Roshi was a very deeply awakened person, but he had a drinking problem. In fact, he used to stay with Webb. So for some people that doesn't make sense. It's like, how could you be deeply enlightened but still have some karmic defects? But, encountering enlightened mind face to face doesn't mean you cease to be human. It means you have experienced your essential nature, but you still have karmic residue. Well, anyway, Eido Roshi is a person, in my opinion, who has serious, karmic residue and hasn't cleaned it up successfully. But, they had the 50th anniversary of, was it the 50th? I guess it was probably the 40th anniversary of their Zen community. And it was amazing the number of people who came to talk about how Eido Roshi had helped them in their lives. It was amazing. And the stories people told were very moving. One guy had been in a nearly fatal car accident. He was very badly deformed by his accident. It must have been an incredible accident. And he talked about how he needed crutches to walk, and his feet were part of his feet had been amputated and so on. But he said, basically he wanted to commit suicide, but Eido Roshi pulled him through, and he was so grateful for his life. And it was just like one story after another like that. And it occurred to me at the time that even though he had a lot of personal defects, his actions had this very powerful magnifying effect. One person entering deep samadhi this morning might seem like very unimportant, except to that person. It's a wonderful experience. But that's a mistake. That's one person who's going to leave here a different person. And once you experience that big life, just you have a little taste of that big life, you realize it's a big world. I've been in a very small world, but it's a big world. And it's really a marvelous, amazing place. So I think that makes a huge difference. We can't really know how much that changes things. When I take care of you, I'm taking care of myself. And when you take care of yourself, you're taking care of me. There's all one life. And this is just an intellectual idea, or it could be a saying on one of these posters that are hanging in the kitchen. but when you begin to experience it, it's pretty amazing, right? Pretty amazing. So anyway, everybody's doing a wonderful job today, right? Wonderful job. And I'm very happy that you're here, still here, and I'm very happy that you're practicing with such courage and wholeheartedness. And even though you may have some painful sits ahead of you, don't be daunted. Continue to have that courage and wholeheartedness, and you won't be disappointed.